session number 4617, reel number 1.
Mr. Armand, Reel 1. When did you first join the RAF?
I joined in 1930. The reason why I joined was that I was from a family. My father had been killed in an accident in my youth. I was a baby, in fact. And I started to work when I left school, from elementary school at the age of 14. I started to work at a chemist's. I suppose in my mind that I thought it was an interesting job, and so anyway I started there, and the manager took a fatherly interest in me, and when I'd been there about a year or so, I was about 15, he said, "What are you going to do in the future? Your mother won't be able to afford to send you on to be a qualified chemist to go to college," he said, "and we can't offer you a career here." So I thought, well, I'll go and see my headmaster at the school. And I went to see him, a very nice man, a Mr. Baldry, and said, repeated what the manager had told me in the chemist, and he said, "Well, I really don't know." He said, bear in mind this was 1930, and the 1929, the age of the time of the Depression, and I lived in Paignton in the South Devon, and there was no work of any sort down there. So he said, "Have you ever thought of the Air Force?" Well, I suppose we didn't see I'd never seen an RAF uniform, and airplanes were just an odd one occasionally, which I hadn't really taken the interest in, but I did think that, oh, that sounds interesting. And he said, "I'll write and find out if you like." So I said, "All right." So he wrote off and came back to me and said, eventually, sort of a week or two, and he said, "I have some papers here," he said, "which I think you would find you may be able to manage," he said, "with my help." And it was the apprentice's examination to go to Halton to be an RAF apprentice. He said, "Are you prepared to come and do some work with me? Because I will help you if you wish." So I said, "Yes, of course I will." So I used to go down to his study in the evenings, and during 1929, and took the examination in September. I found that I was 340th out of 400 accepted, but there were 1,250 boys who took the examination, and mostly they were all grammar school boys, whereas mine had been an elementary education.
Why do you think that headmaster suggested the RAF? Did he have some connection?
No, he had no connection. But I suppose I was the first boy, in fact, from the school. In fact, I think I was the first boy in the whole of Paignton to join the RAF as an apprentice. In fact, as I said in the first instance, I'd never seen an RAF uniform. But anyway, I did manage to pass the examination, and we went off to Halton, and was accepted, and medical examinations followed, and so on, you know, and I was fit. I was allocated to the trade of metal rigger.
Before we go on to Halton,
yes.
Could I ask you, if you can remember, what it was that that headmaster said about the RAF which attracted you?
I don't think I can really. Whether it was the thrill of aeroplanes and thinking that I might be able to fly, I don't know. Really, what? Because it was a naval area down there. We always saw Plymouth, and we always saw sailors around, and a few army people. There weren't many, but except the barracks at Plymouth, there were no barracks around Paignton. It was a seaside resort, of course. I don't really know, but it was a very fortuitous thought of his, because I had a wonderful life and I enjoyed it.
Did you know at that time anything about the career prospects in the RAF?
No, I accepted that my headmaster's thoughts. I remember that he said you would have to serve for 12 years. And of course, at the age of 15, 12 years is a long, long time. Yeah? In fact, it was 12 years from the age of 18. So it meant, in fact, almost 15 years, of course. No, I think my main thoughts was whether I'd be able to pass the examination. You see, it dealt in the examination dealt in the usual grammar school subjects which we barely touched on in the elementary school.
What type of a reputation did the RAF have amongst the civilian population at that time, do you think?
It was non-existent. The RAF was unknown down there. You see, there was an RAF station at Mount Batten, at Plymouth, flying boats, but we rarely, that might have been one of the ones I saw occasionally, but there were rarely any flying boats came up our way at all. I think it was purely fortuitous that I did sort of select that career. Yeah.
So once you'd been accepted for the RAF, what happened to you then?
When I'd been accepted, all the papers and the acceptance and a railway warrant arrived on Christmas Day. We had Christmas Day postage in those days, and we had a very tearful sort of day with my mother that day. You don't really want me to go away, and I said, well, I don't. It looked, you know, I was excited by that time about it, and the fact that I'd passed the examination, and she was very good. She didn't persuade me not to. She saw that I was really interested, and she knew that there was nothing in Paignton for youngsters. The boys did go away, you know, leave the town that time to work, or else they were just service jobs, as they're called now, in the seaside industry, you know. There's nothing there at all. There were no industry at all of any sort.
So when you got to Halton, what were your first impressions of the place?
Well, my first impression, of course, we went up and we were met at Baker Street. We had to make our own way to Baker Street, and where we were met by an RAF corporal and an officer and one or two other NCOs who shepherded us all together onto one train, and we went to Wendover. Of course, we were 400 or 500 boys, all the same age, all excited about the prospects, and we're all sort of wondering what's coming next, you know, at that age. I know that for the first perhaps 2 or 3 weeks there was a large number of us crying ourselves to sleep at night, you know, never been away from home before. But there was no time to think. You were kept active all the time, and very quickly sorted out into trades and squadrons and flights for accommodation purposes, and taught the rudiments of marching in order to move around in a disciplined manner. Had to break ourselves into the food, which was ample but rough. I suppose we soon settled down. It was
what was the discipline like there?
The discipline was rigid. There was no smoking allowed. Our pay was 7 shillings a day, 7 shillings a week, shilling a day. 4 shillings of the 7 was held back. 3 shillings we were given each week. And the 3 shillings was our total sum of money to buy soaps, any other necessities we needed, our cups of tea at the canteen, 4 pence to go to the cinema. Of course, there was no smoking allowed. Some of the boys did smoke, of course, and they got caught and they were severely punished.
What type of punishment would they get?
Imprisonment eventually, and to start with, they'd be given defaulters, 7 days defaulters, 14 days defaulters, 21 days defaulters. Then it would be imprisonment, and if they were caught again after that, they'd be sent away to the Royal Air Force glass houses, as we used to call them. Oh yes, really, really, what's the name? One boy was flogged.
What for?
Stealing. He stole the post office bank book, you know.
Or was he flogged in public?
Yes, we all prayed in and all prayed on the square. One boy was drummed out of the service for stealing. I suppose it was a fine training. There's never been a training like it and anywhere. Which the evidence of it came later on during the war years, you see.
When you say flogged, do you mean caned?
Yes, caned, yes. Stretched over a table and caned, yes.
How did the boys react to that, the boys who were watching?
It was a salutary warning to us, you know. We were very subdued afterwards.
And how did he take it?
Well, I don't remember really, but I should think he would have been very subdued. I had one small punishment myself. We had a system amongst us of leading boys, you know, in each room full of boys, you'd have one from a senior entry who would be called a leading boy, and he'd be given one stripe and he'd be in charge of the room, and it was his task to see that we all had room jobs to do, and every morning the place had to be spick and span and laid out according to a picture in which was there, brooms, scrub brooms and scrub table, beds made up in the style of an armchair. These were iron beds, the MacDonald type of bed, with 3 separate biscuits, and you made them up every morning to form an armchair to sit in. And they all had to be dead in line, and knife, fork and spoon. I suppose much worse than what is called a borstel nowadays, but this was accepted by us. It was no hardship to it at all. We were all doing exactly the same, and we all wore the same uniform. The only difference between say a boy who came from a a better class family than another one was in the number of parcels of food he used to receive from home. That was all. And of course sport was a big, very great thing. We had, everyone was willy-nilly, you had to become a sportsman of some sort. You were tested out in every sort of game to see what abilities you had, and we found we had, some of us had abilities which we never realised. I became a runner because I was useless at football. I couldn't play football, I couldn't shoot, you know, but I enjoyed running. I joined the cross country team, and running was my pastime there.
You didn't finish explaining how you got punished yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, well, the punishment, I was, one morning I was a bit behind, and our leading boy was a bit of a man who liked his authority, and he always used to shout in the morning, you know, come on parade, get on parade, 5 minutes before anyone else. And I hadn't finished my room job, and this particular time he said, come on, Armand, you get on parade, you're always late, you see. And I said, oh, bugger off. And he reported me, and I received 7 days defaulters for that.
What did you have to do on defaulters?
Oh, well, defaulters was, you had to do your normal work. We always had homework every evening, either schoolwork or writing up notes from the workshops. And of course, you had to do that as well as your fatigues. We had fatigues in the evening, some of which you'd be detailed to go to the cookhouse and wash tins for an hour, or go and polish the floor in the guard room, if ever that were a useless task. That was a large square of lino in the middle of the guard room, and you had to polish that and polish it and polish it. We never whitewashed stones, not that sort of, the army, that was one of the army's things, we never did. Polished brasses right throughout the barrack block, there were all brass plates on all the doors and brass rails. Any sort of demeaning sort of task, I suppose. And then of course there was weekends, you didn't do any of those duties, but you had to, 1 hour in working dress, 1 hour in best blue, 1 hour in working dress, 1 hour in best blue, right throughout the day, until the last parade was at 9 o'clock, and 9:30 was lights out. You had to report to the guard room 5 minutes after reveille at 6:30. You know, you're really pushed during the day to carry on with your normal training and to do these duties as well.
Did you feel that the punishment which you got for telling the leading boy to bugger off was fair or not?
Oh yes, I accepted it as natural, yes. And it didn't, in fact, it didn't have any effect on my own career there, because a month afterwards I was made a leading boy myself. You know, that...
How were the leading boys selected?
I think the leading boy was selected from recommendations, first of all, from on each floor. The barrack block had two rooms on each floor, and three floors in the building. And there was a corporal, a regular NCO corporal on each floor living in. He would have the first selection, and then there was a sergeant to each barrack block, a disciplinary sergeant who took us on drill, and there was a warrant officer in charge of two barrack blocks, which made up one squadron, and they all were given a choice, given the word with the flight commander or squadron commander, you see. And it was the squadron commander's final recommendation.
When you became leading boy yourself, did you find it an easy job?
The privileges were few, because there were few privileges that could be given, except you had a room of your own instead of living in a room with the other boys. That was a mixed blessing, because you tended to become isolated, of course, but otherwise you had more duties to perform, because you were responsible for the cleanliness of the room and the discipline of the boys in your room. One little story I remember. In the summer, where I was in C squadron of number 2 wing at Holton, and C squadron was the next to the Nappy block, and in the back of the Nappy, the staff's bedrooms were on the back of the building looking towards our barrack block. One young girl, I can't remember her name, but she promised one of the boys in our room that she would give him a thrill, you see, after lights out, and she pulled back her curtains and undressed. And we were all standing in our pajamas, looking out of the window across there in our room, only our room, you see. And we were completely unaware of the sergeant major walking into the room with his dog. Now, this Sergeant Major Ripley, he had an Alsatian dog, and he had come along and seen us up there, and walked up the stairs and into the room. We were completely unaware. And the first thing he knew was when he shouted, "Stand by your beds." You see. Do you know what he did? He made us all get dressed and took us out on the square for half an hour's drill. Yeah. In the dark. It was dark by that time. Yeah. Instant punishment. I expect he reported to the flight commander, but he was free to do that sort of thing, you see.
What was this girl doing on the base? What job did she
have? Oh, there were girls who were served in the canteen. Served behind the counter and cleared the tables, you know. I had a staff of a manageress and 3 or 4 girls, I suppose, who lived in, the girls lived in. Poor girl, she lost her job and was marched off the camp next morning. Yeah.
Coming back to the job of leading boy, was it difficult to exercise discipline over the other boys?
No, this wasn't a difficulty at all. It was accepted. We soon learnt to accept it, you know, there was an implied threat behind every order, but you soon learnt that if you were told to do something, you did it. This was a discipline which became ingrained and second nature to us. I'm rather proud of the apprenticeship, in after years, one of the ex-apprentices became chief of the air staff. You know, the bulk of the apprentices were all commissioned during the war. I wasn't, but that's another story.
Could we go on next to the actual training that you got at Holton?
Yes.
Did the new entry of boys with whom you entered, did they all receive the same training at Holton?
No. We were divided into trades, you see. When we took our entrance examination, we were offered a choice of trades, and the trades were aero engine fitter, metal rigger, armourer, in that order, at Holton, wireless fitter, instrument fitter, and electrician. Now, those six trades, those three trades, were the boys were accepted for those. They went off to Cranwell. They were attested at Halton, given the uniforms and basic training for 3 weeks, and then they left and went off to Halton, to Cranwell. And what it boiled down to was the higher your position in the entrance examination, the better chance you had of being selected for your trade, you see. I put down in the first place to be my choice to be an aero engine fitter, and the second choice to be a metal rigger, not knowing, I suppose, what a metal rigger was intended to be, but an aero engine fitter, well, everyone knew what an engine is, you see. And that was the first choice of most of the boys. So the first, if you didn't receive either of those trades, then you became an armourer.
So you got your second choice.
I got my second choice as being a metal rigger. And then once the training started, we were separated in the workshops. The metal rigger side all were at one end, more or less, and the engine fitters the other end. There were also some other trades of blacksmith and coppersmith. These were one or two boys, well, I suppose perhaps a dozen of each boy, of each trade, who showed an aptitude that way after a basic training.
Could you describe what your work involved as a trainee rigger?
Yes, we were given, the time was divided between academical work and a school and workshop training. To take the workshop training first of all, we started off with basic filing with a chunk of metal and to file it square to make a cube, and that was followed on with a minor fitting job, a hexagon to fit into a cast iron block, and we learnt the use of gauges and all the different tools and things during this period. Each practical lesson was interspersed with a theoretical lesson, when we had our own instructor and he would demonstrate each movement as we went along, and we gradually progressed from this filing of solid blocks in the metal rigging side to making plate fittings, filing out sheet metal and aluminium, steel, stainless steel, bending radiuses, shaping, fitting, riveting, and along that way, all gradually aiming towards the eventual construction of a complete aeroplane, which we did during our 3 years training there. We built the ribs from scratch, spars, the main spar that runs through the ribs, the fuselage. We were taught coppersmithing, metal beating, cadmium plating, aging and treatment of duralumin, stainless steel, hardening and tempering, all the basic trades, and before we got on to the constructional trades.